Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcasts, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Going Underground, France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with Afshin Ratansi's Going Underground. Afshin spoke with retired U.S. Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Colin Powell. They begin talking about the increased risk of the use of nuclear weapons triggered by the wars in Ukraine and Palestine. They discuss who is complicit in the massive number of deaths in Gaza, U.S. politicians attacking the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, and who was involved in the assassination of the Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in 1995. Wilkerson criticizes the new policy of Ukraine using U.S. weapons for attacks inside Russian borders. Going Underground.
Joining me from Falls Church in Virginia in the USA is a former U.S. Army officer of 30 years. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson was chief of staff at a State Department which, like Antony Blinken's, appeared an unconditional supporter of Israel. Thank you so much, Colonel, for coming back on burning and beheaded babies in Rafah, multiple Hiroshima's worth of TNT equivalent on Gaza, and today the anniversary of the now-ended INF nuclear treaty. How near is the world to nuclear use? Now, Senior Senator Lindsey Graham talking about Israel and nuclear weapons. Just the other day, a congressman said Gaza should be nuked.
It's interesting that you bring up the INF Treaty. It was Colin Powell's greatest, he thought, achievement with President Reagan when he was National Security Advisor and Deputy. And he said it was the most important nuclear weapons treaty of all because those weapons were the most dangerous of all. And now we've destroyed them, starting with George Bush and the ABM Treaty, which was an unbridled, stupid, unwise act to abrogate that treaty. And he did it essentially because the neoconservatives in his government wanted him to, so that, one, they could make money off the enormously expensive apparatus associated with BMD, but also because they hated the world, as they do everybody other than us, and wanted to make sure that in the future they could defend themselves against a nuclear strike, contemplating that they would launch that strike. So that's how dangerous eliminating the INF Treaty was, and throw the others into it. And I don't want to leave out the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. You may have seen recently former Luftwaffe General Harald Koja gave a disquisition, an hour-long presentation, a brilliant presentation, erudite, citing Alexander the Great, Clausewitz, number of other people. But he had described how stupid, how unwise our strategy is today in what we're doing in Ukraine and Gaza and elsewhere. I don't know where this country's going, but I do know it's not any positive place anytime soon.
When National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, Biden's advisor, said as regards why the U.S. is sending weapons to Israel, committing genocide, according to most people around the world, he said, what we're going to be looking at is whether there is a lot of death and destruction from this operation as regards the May the 15th, another $1 billion of U.S. public money sent to Netanyahu. Did he facilitate this Holocaust in Rafah?
Of course he did. Everyone who's complicit in it has facilitated it, from President Joseph Biden down to the lowest member of the United States government, who now has not walked out and resigned in shame and anger over the policy. Let's back up just for a minute. If you look at what is happening in the ICJ and the ICC. We are seeing the first display of more or less balanced international justice. In the past, the ICC, basically a captive of the non-signatory power, the United States, only went after black people in Africa. And then when the Balkans erupted, they went after their first white people, Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic, but still going after people that the CIA and the United States declared their enemies. Now suddenly they've grown up. Now suddenly they've got a pair of cojones. Now suddenly they're actually doing international justice. And look at what the great bastion of international justice heretofore has said about that. We have even had Congress members who have called the family and members of the ICC and threatened them. This is not the way a hegemon or a decent country or a country interested in its reputation and future acts. It's the way a country acts that is lost and building the rest of the world, like the BRICS, for example, into a balancing entity to take care of it. And mark my words, that will happen.
So you see that as the mask being off, because a lot of people say the International Caucasian Court, as you intimate, gave him another month, the Israelis, to continue committing genocide, and were even-handed. They equated resistance to occupation with the response to October the 7th and arguable continual violations of UN Security Council resolutions in West Bank, in Jerusalem, that are continuing right now.
But that was an astute move, in my view. Jurisprudence is jurisprudence, but you have to live in the world. And it was a very balanced decision to take the three principal leaders of Hamas and Yoav Gallant and Bibi Netanyahu on the other side. I'd have thrown some other people in there. I'd have thrown Ben Gavir in there for sure, bloodthirsty zealot that he is. Ben Gavir would kill every Palestinian man, woman, and child in a heartbeat if he had the apparatus and the method to do it. So I'd have thrown him in there just to make it a little more balanced, 3-3, if you will. But the court has to live in the world, and I think it's a good decision.
Yeah, well, it hasn't stopped the killing. And, of course, there have been reports that there were threats to the judges before they were making their deliberations. But you mentioned Ben Gavir. You know, the Israeli Labor Party chief said that Gavir and Netanyahu were collaborators in the killing of Rabin in Israel. Maybe you can tell me how, because of course they deny it, about that. And can you tell
me? Watch the video that the Israeli filmmakers put together. And of course that we squashed as soon as it crossed the ocean and was shown in this country. But it's a brilliantly put together video, because about 2/3 of the video, the documentary, is actual footage, including actual footage of the assassination. And from that video, made by Jewish filmmakers, mind you, in Israel, that video shows how Netanyahu stirred up the crowds, got the crowds to be violent and uproarious, and knew exactly what he was doing, knew what would happen, probably even knew the group from which the assassin would come. And of course, after the assassination, some years later, he resurrected him and made him a hero in the settler community. So Bibi was as responsible for the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin as we, the United States of America, are now responsible for the genocide in Gaza.
What do you make of this seeming debate about whether the U.S. should, like Britain, allow weaponry to target Russia within Russia?
It's a stupid debate. It's an unwise debate. It's a cruel debate. It's a brutal debate, and it makes no sense whatsoever. Let's just take, for example, the recent shot at Russia's early warning system for ballistic missiles shot from the United States at Russia. That is the worst possible thing you can do with regard to their strategic warning system. So had it been the situation that existed a couple of times in my experience when I was inside the military, there would have been a debate about whether or not to launch. Because when you take out something that serious, that critical for over-the-horizon radar warning about ballistic missiles coming into your country, you don't have very long to debate and very long to decide you're going to shoot back. This was a very unwise move. It was a stupid move, first giving them the missiles that could do it, and then apparently approving the target that they chose to shoot. Makes no sense at all unless you're trying to get a nuclear war started, and God forbid that anybody's trying to do that. No sense at all.
Colonel Larry Wilkerson, thank you.
That interview is excerpted from Afshin Ratansi's twice weekly program called Going Underground. It is available at Apple and other podcast sites, as well as a Canadian website, rumble.com, which has video. I highly recommend listening to the entire interview with Lawrence Wilkerson. Next, France 24. A report on demonstrations against the war in Gaza in the French Parliament and on the streets of many French cities. Israel bombed a school housing displaced Palestinians in central Gaza run by the United Nations. France 24.
I'm joined by Andrew Smith, a historian of modern France and a lecturer at Queen Mary University. Andrew, now we're starting this week with tension over the war in Gaza that spilled into the French Parliament and back into the streets. Paris saw three consecutive nights of protests this week over the offensive in the southern city of Rafah. Protests also took place in other cities, from Marseille to Lyon. And meanwhile, in the National Assembly on Tuesday, a lawmaker from the far-left France Unbowed party was suspended for 2 weeks and given a temporary pay cut after he held up a Palestinian flag. Now, that took place as lawmakers were discussing the issue of Palestinian statehood, which was recognized this week by Ireland, Spain, and Norway. Andrew, obviously, this is a divisive issue in all countries with large Jewish and Muslim diaspora populations, but how have we seen it reverberating politically here in France?
Yeah, absolutely. It's remained a very hot issue in France. And of course, immediately after his deputy was banned, Jean-Luc Mélenchon of France Unbowed complained that, you know, it had been fine for the assembly to fly the Ukrainian flag back in 2022. Now, of course, the law in the assembly doesn't ban the flying of foreign flags, but instead the use of other kind of things to kind of make those protests. You know, we've seen before people wearing yellow vests, the assembly member, deputy Jean Lassalle from down the Pyrénées-Atlantiques, and other people like that causing problems. But it's really this Gaza issue which has been huge. And we've seen it also in mayoral protests. You mentioned in Marseille, Lyon, and we also saw it in Montpellier, where the town halls are darkening their lights at night in protest against this. So there's been a lot of really back and forth about this. And of course, on the European elections as well, the Republicans, the centre-right party, had a kind of flashpoint moment where their candidate for the European elections leading the list confronted a France Unbowed protester at Sciences Po, at one of these kind of encampments outside. So it's been a really kind of hot topic, of course, right across French politics and touching a lot of different issues at the same time.
Yeah, definitely something that's going to continue to rile up French politics in the weeks to come.
In the dead of night in Nuseirat, an Israeli rocket killed dozens of Palestinians at this UNRWA-run school, now housing displaced Gazans.
We were sleeping when we suddenly saw a rocket falling on us. On the second floor, people were killed, and on the first floor, people were injured. That's all we saw.
Survivors scrambled to save the wounded, but the bodies piled high at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, where families gathered to grieve their loved ones on Thursday morning. Galia Mansour's son was among the victims.
My son called us at 2:30 in the morning to say that my other son, Ahmed, had been killed. They hit them with a missile in the classroom, in the school. We came here. We haven't slept. He's the youngest one of my sons, and my dearest.
UNRWA schools across the Strip have widely been used as shelters for the displaced in Gaza since the outbreak of the war, and this is not the first time Israel has targeted them. The Israeli military has said this was a precise attack, targeting between 20 and 30 Hamas militants allegedly operating within the school, also claiming to have taken steps to protect civilians.
Those reports were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. on to Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. United Nations Secretary General Guterres called for taxes on fossil fuel companies to help pave for the fight against climate change. Then an interview with a climate scientist from California about the latest World Meteorological Organization's report on the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming threshold known as the Paris Agreement. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The UN's Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has called for a tax on the profits of fossil fuel companies to help pay for the fight against climate change. He said time may be running out to control rising global temperatures. This comes as a new report indicates last month was the hottest May on record and the 12th straight monthly record high.
Last month was the hottest May on record. After a year of higher than normal weather, the world is feeling the impact. India is in drought, with voters this week casting ballots in 47 degrees Celsius temperatures. Greece saw its worst wildfire season, with more than 20 recorded fatalities. And there have been more than 60 deaths amid a heat wave in Mexico as water resources dwindle. Outdoor workers are struggling to beat the heat. A new report from the UN estimates that temperatures could keep rising with worsening effect.
We are playing Russian roulette with our planet. And we need an exit ramp off the highway to climate hell. And the truth is we have control of the wheel. The 1.5 degree limit is still just about possible.
Limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius is a goal established under the Paris Agreement. With it, countries committed to keeping long-term median global temperatures below pre-industrial levels. The UN Weather Agency believes this bout of heat is human-induced and could become more frequent.
There's an 80% likelihood that the annual average global temperature will temporarily exceed 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels for at least one of the next five calendar years.
The agency is calling on the Group of 20 to reel in the fossil fuel industry and limit carbon output. The G20 is holding a summit in Brazil next month, where they are set to discuss the environment and an energy transition.
Zeke Hausfather is a climate scientist at the nonprofit Berkeley Earth, and he joins us now from Oakland in California. Now, the World Meteorological Organization says there is an 80% chance that we'll hit the 1.5 degrees threshold from the Paris Agreement within the next 5 years. What's your reaction to that assessment?
So what they're saying is that there's an 80% chance that one of the years in the next 5 years will be above 1.5 degrees. That doesn't necessarily mean the world has passed the UN temperature target, which is in reference to a longer term average. So when we think about climate change, there's human-induced warming, but there's also some year-to-year variability. And most of that is driven by El Nino and La Nina events that cause some additional warming or cooling, respectively. Right now, we're in the midst of a big El Nino event, and so global temperatures are actually approaching 1.5 degrees. In fact, the last 12 months, as Copernicus reported, have been about 1.6 degrees above pre-industrial levels. But that's going to fade a little bit as a La Nina event develops. And so our best estimate remains that the world is going to firmly pass 1.5 degrees in the late 2020s or early 2030s if we don't reduce emissions quickly.
So are you saying that we are still on track for that?
Currently, the world is on track to pass 1.5 degrees in the next 10 years. And to not be on track to do that, we'd have to make some pretty radical changes in terms of reducing global emissions very quickly. We also have the potential to pass 1.5 degrees temporarily and bring temperatures back down later in the century, which is what most IPCC models do these days, if we remove more carbon from the atmosphere than we're adding after net zero. But that's a big lift. It's a lot easier not to pass it in the first place than to try to recover from it.
Now, we've heard Antonio Guterres today saying he's calling for a windfall tax on fossil fuel companies. Can the fossil fuel industry fix the problem that they created?
So I don't think they have the incentive to fix the problem they created. And in fact, as long as fossil fuel companies can make money selling fossil fuels, they're going to do so. The only way to stop the world from warming is to get our global emissions of CO2 all the way down to zero, which means no more burning of oil, gas, or coal, unless that's counterbalanced with permanent removal of carbon from the atmosphere, which is quite expensive. Now, maybe there's a way that oil and gas companies can play a role in some of the solutions and things like geothermal energy, in carbon capture and storage or carbon dioxide removal. But that's going to be a very different market than they're in today. There's not really a world where oil and gas companies are still selling oil and gas 30, 40 years from now if we're on track to meet our climate goals.
Now, we've also heard news today of this May being the hottest May ever and marking the 12th straight monthly record high. You've mentioned things like El Nino, but is warming accelerating?
So there's a big debate in the community right now about whether or not the rate of warming is accelerating. My personal view is that there's increasing evidence that it is, in part because that's also what our climate models expect to happen in a world where we're not reducing emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases, but we are reducing emissions of planet-cooling aerosols. So some of the things that we put up in the atmosphere as a byproduct of burning coal, oil, and gas, like sulfur dioxide, actually have a cooling effect on the planet. And those have historically masked about a third of the warming that the world would have otherwise experienced. We've been cleaning the air up really quickly in places like the US and Europe. There's a recent regulation to clean up the sulfur emissions from ships. And all of this is contributing to a pretty stark decline in emissions of sulfur dioxide, which is a planet cooling effect. And so that's really supercharging this underlying warming trend from CO2. And so because of that, there's increasing evidence that the rate of warming has increased in recent decades. And there's a paper today, just out today, that suggested that the world is now warming at a rate of about not 0.26 C per decade, which is about 50% faster than the rate we've seen on average since 1970.
Thank you for those insights. Zeke Hausfather with Berkeley Earth. Thank you.
That report was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, as well as most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program like listeners in New York City and Ashland, Oregon did this week, you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. My online support information is available at outfarpress.com. Many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. A United Nations climate executive says that the increasing use of renewable energy is making pledges at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change conference made last year possible. In Mexico, the resounding victory of President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum was hailed widely. The U.S. Congress voted to sanction the International Criminal Court over the arrest warrant for Netanyahu. Radio Havana, Cuba.
A global goal to triple the production of electricity from clean sources such as solar and wind power by 2030 is, quote, ambitious but achievable, says the world's leading independent energy analyst. Nearly 200 countries, including the world's biggest polluters, pledged themselves to that goal in Dubai last December under the auspices of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That and an accompanying pledge to double energy efficiency in the next 6 years are designed to keep the world's average temperature no higher than 1.5 degrees Celsius. UN Climate Change Executive Secretary Simon Stahil hailed the agreement as, quote, the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era. In a new report out on Tuesday, the International Energy Agency, the IEA, says while official commitments cover only 12% of the goal at the moment, their domestic ambitions go further, covering 70% of the goal and putting them within reach of it. Half of the newly installed renewable energy capacity would come in the form of solar panels, another quarter in wind turbines, and the rest from sources like geothermal and hydroelectric power, this according to the IEA. Quote, if all ambitions were to be achieved, global installed renewable capacity would be 2.2 times the 2022 level by 2030, according to the report. Leaders from across the Americas have offered congratulations to Claudia Sheinbaum, whose overwhelming victory in Mexico's national election will make her the first woman to hold the presidency in the country's history. Officials from countries including Brazil, Chile, and the United States have offered praise for the newly minted president-elect, who won Sunday's election with more than 59% of the vote. Sheinbaum will represent the left-leaning National Regeneration Movement, Morena Party, when she takes office October the 1st. Sheinbaum will succeed current President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known by his initials AMLO, who founded the Morena Party. During her campaign, Sheinbaum pledged to move his signature policies forward during her six-year term in office. López Obrador leaves office in September as one of the most popular world leaders in office today. His approval rating has consistently remained higher than 60%. His track record in office has included the advancement of progressive priorities, such as the expansion of social programs for the poor. But López Obrador has also helmed controversial initiatives, including expanding the military's mandate and collaboration with the United States to crack down on northward migration. Sheinbaum has a close professional relationship with López Obrador, who appointed her as his Secretary of the Environment when he led Mexico's government starting in 2000. Leaders on the political left across Latin America, with whom López Obrador has pursued strong ties, expressed optimism after Sunday's vote showed Sheinbaum with a sizable victory over a conservative-leaning coalition. U.S. lawmakers at the House of Representatives have approved pending legislation that sanctions the International Criminal Court, the ICC, over war crimes warrant for Israeli leaders. According to sources on Capitol Hill, this is the first of several steps that would be needed before these sanctions actually become law. But observers say that this is significant in that the U.S. House of Representatives, that has long toyed with the idea of sanctioning justices of the ICC, has now made good on that threat. With a vote of 247 to 155, the U.S. legislators passed the measure that proposes sanctions against ICC judges and staff members, as well as their family members, and involved anyone who has prosecuted American citizens or citizens of U.S. allies, Israel, that are not party to the International Criminal Court. This is something that was touted by Republicans right after the ICC's chief prosecutor tried to get arrest warrants issued against the Israeli leader. The vote on Tuesday had 42 Democrats joining their Republican colleagues in approving this measure, which is also significant given that this is pushing back against the White House that just yesterday said it strongly opposes the measure.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu. There's no podcasts. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You will have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Find information for making online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm recuperating from spinal injury, I'm staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.